Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Join the millions of players around the world and bring in the new year with the all-time favorite classic match three game, Candy Crush Saga. It's fun to play and challenging to master, with thousands of levels to switch and match your way through. Get that sweet feeling this new year with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Monday, the 6th of January, these are our main stories. Iran says it will no longer abide by limits on its enrichment of uranium, in effect abandoning the international nuclear deal reached in 2015. The US embassy in Iraq has been targeted by rocket fire again following the American assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad. There's been a major split in the Venezuelan opposition in a significant blow to its leader, Juan Guaido. Also in this podcast.
Because this very new wine is so highly thought of, and because today is the first day that the French government allows it to be sold, cases and cases of it have been rushed across from France in a fierce competition to be first to get the wine to the drinker.
The French winemaker Georges Deboeuf, who turned Beaujolais Nouveau into a global phenomenon, has died at the age of 86. Iran says it will breach a key commitment it made in its agreement with the outside world to curb its nuclear program. A government statement said the country would no longer heed any restriction on the number of centrifuge devices it can use. This latest development comes at a time of extreme tension following the US airstrike on Friday in Baghdad that killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. As hundreds of thousands of Iranians turned out on Sunday to honour his remains on their arrival in his homeland, there were furious scenes inside Iraq's parliament. MPs were heard shouting, "Iraq is free, America, get out." The Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament, Mohammed al-Halbousi, called on Iraq's foreign minister to submit a complaint against the US at the United Nations for violating the country's sovereignty. He said American and other foreign troops were no longer welcome.
The Iraqi government should abide to end the presence of any foreign forces in the Iraqi territories and prevent them from using the lands, water, and the sky of Iraq for any reason.
I spoke to our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston and began by asking him about the development by Tehran that it will breach a key commitment it made in its agreement with the rest of the world to curb its nuclear program.
This a really big development. We're talking here about that major nuclear accord that the Iranians struck with the US during the time of the Obama administration and the Europeans, the Russians and the Chinese. President Trump hated the nuclear agreement, called it one of the worst in American history and abandoned it in the middle of 2017. Later, the Iranians started breaching elements of the accord in a phased way, but today they've gone much further. After a cabinet meeting, they said they would no longer respect any limits on the devices with which they enrich uranium, wouldn't respect any limit on the amount of uranium they could enrich or store. And of course, enriched uranium is what can be used in nuclear weapons. It should be said the Iranians always say their nuclear program is entirely peaceful, but this is really quite far-reaching. It amounts to effectively the Iranians disregarding the nuclear accord, although they haven't actually spelt that out. They say they will continue to allow international watchdogs in to watch their processes, though.
Meanwhile, we had this resolution from the Iraqi parliament. What does it mean?
Well, this US airstrike caused absolute outrage in Iraq. Not only did it kill the powerful Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, it also killed an Iraqi militia commander. Iraq's leaders were outraged, as I say. They saw this as a gross breach of their sovereignty, not the way that an ally should behave. And that anger has been channeled into a parliamentary resolution demanding an expulsion of American troops. It wasn't unanimous. There were powerful Shia Muslim bloc that drove it through. They're close to the Iranians. The Sunni Muslim bloc and the Kurdish bloc in parliament didn't back the resolution. They worry about Iran's influence in Iraq, so they're happier to have the Americans in the country.
Alan Johnston. With the war of words between the United States and Iran intensifying, Tehran has sworn revenge. One of its closest allies is Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Washington blames for a suicide bombing in 1983 in Beirut, which killed 241 American servicemen. The Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, said that following Qasem Soleimani's death, US soldiers would return home in coffins. He listed the targets.
American Army bases, battleships and every American soldier in our lands. The US Army is the one who killed Qasem Soleimani, and it will pay the price. It's the beginning of a new phase, a new history, and for the whole region.
It's emerged that at least two rockets have landed inside the heavily fortified green zone in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. One report, quoting witnesses, said they fell near the US embassy. In his latest tweet, President Trump has said yet again that the US will strike back if Iran hits any American target. The president said he was notifying the US Congress of his intention. Earlier, President Trump threatened Tehran that if it retaliated against the US, 52 Iranian targets would be hit, in his words, very fast and very hard, one for each of the American hostages seized in 1979. I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Jane O'Brien, and she began by giving me the reaction there to Sunday's vote in the Iraqi parliament.
Well, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has been doing the morning rounds on American TV networks, and he said that he was only watching the situation very closely, but wouldn't speculate as to what might happen next. Now, the Americans are in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. So if that vote does lead to any actual demands for them to leave, then they will have to leave. That wouldn't necessarily affect Mr. Trump too badly among his supporters, because a lot of them are already questioning why American troops are in the Middle East at all. But clearly it would reduce America's influence in the region and could be seen as a major victory for Iran.
But the United States has also changed its strategy on the forces it has in the region right now already, hasn't it?
That's right. Separately, the Pentagon has announced that it is now too unsafe to continue conducting operations against Islamic State, and that it is now concentrating on protecting its bases and its personnel where they are. Now, it has not linked that statement or that change of mission to the killing of Soleimani. It has said that that is due to 2 months of rocket attacks from Hezbollah and the death of an American contractor. But I think it gives you an idea of just how unstable America sees the region.
Can you then bring us up to date on the current state of the back and forth between the US and Iran in the aftermath of the killing?
We've seen a series of counter threats and a ratcheting up of tensions, even as people were calling for restraint. President Trump conducted a flurry of tweets last night, warning Iraq that any retaliation would be met like for like, and also threatened to target sites of cultural importance to Iran. Now, again, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was asked specifically about that today, because any targeting of a cultural site, a cultural heritage site, is a war crime under international law. He said that America was not considering any illegal action and that it would carry out any countermeasures in an entirely lawful fashion.
Jane O'Brien in Washington. The US military says three of its personnel were killed during the jihadist attack on a military base on the Kenyan coast. The base in Manda Bay is close to the tourist destination of Lamu Island. Ann Soy has this report.
The US Africa Command says it lost a soldier and two other staff in the daring drone attack by Al-Shabaab. The Somali-based group has issued a contradicting statement claiming that it killed 17 American personnel and 9 Kenyans. This is no doubt a significant development in the group's 13-year existence and one that's likely to attract a strong response from the American forces and its allies. American military casualties in the region are rare. One soldier was killed during an operation against Al-Shabaab in Somalia in 2017. The U.S. Africa Command said today's attack involved indirect and small arms fire in which 6 civilian aircraft were damaged. Earlier, the Kenya Defense Forces said 5 bodies of militants were found at the scene.
And soy. Now to Venezuela, where there have been chaotic scenes outside the National Assembly as the opposition leader Juan Guaido was stopped from entering the building to be re-elected as its head. Video footage appears to show police blocking him. After that, he started climbing the railings. Despite his efforts inside, in a major blow to his campaign, Venezuela's opposition split, with a faction joining the governing Socialist Party to choose a new head of the National Assembly, Luis Parra. He's a dissident opposition politician and Mr. Guaido's rival. Rochelle Krieger is from The Washington Post and is in Caracas.
A vote to re-elect opposition leader Juan Guaido as president of this country's National Assembly was scheduled to happen this morning. Guaido is the opposition leader that has been leading a fight backed by the U.S. and others to oust President Nicolás Maduro since last year. And being reelected was vital to his movement, but pro-Maduro security guards blocked his and his backers' entry, as well as journalists, and suddenly a dissenting lawmaker was being sworn in on national TV. That lawmaker, his name is Luis Parra, was fired from his opposition party after corruption allegations last month. At this point, it's still not clear if there was a vote at all or if there was quorum to swear Parra in. The opposition is calling it a parliamentary coup. They're saying they'll hold a separate session to show that they have a majority. And this might set the country up for having added to 2 parallel presidents, now 2 parallel parliaments. So 2020 is set to be a tough year for Venezuelans with a lot of uncertainty.
Yes, of course, the context to all this is the crumbling of Venezuela's economy in recent years. We've seen empty shelves with basic necessities in short supply. We've seen millions fleeing across the borders. What is life like there now?
The past years have been brutal for people who live here. Public services are destroyed. Caracas, we can say, is a little better than cities in interior states, but most of the population here has serious issues accessing water. Transportation barely works. Hospitals are an absolute nightmare. No medicines and a terrible exodus of doctors and nurses. And on top of that, there have been months where food has been scarce. It's too expensive for most people as hyperinflation has destroyed purchasing power. And wages are simply not enough to live here unless you have savings or earn a significant amount of dollars. And there's always the sense of uncertainty of what's going to happen in the political sense. And you always hear people frantically talking about what's coming and everyone complaining about their loved ones leaving the country, and frankly, a lot of emptiness in the streets.
Rochelle Krieger from the Washington Post in Caracas. Now to Chile, and with the number of HIV cases rising by a third over the past decade, the country has the fastest growing HIV problem in Latin America. Experts say it's partly down to a lack of affordable testing, but the main reason is the poor access to sex education in schools and the stigma surrounding it. Although that's starting to change, it's not just the youngsters who need educating, as Paige Sutherland reports from Santiago.
Gracias. Yo lo dejo entonces con el doctor Ramiro.
Bueno, muy buenas tardes a todas y todos.
Parents have packed into a classroom in Juan Verdargo High School to hear why sex education is on their children's curriculum. For the first time, the pupils will be learning about HIV, and Dr. Romero Molina has a stark warning. It's an epidemic in Chile, he tells the mothers and fathers. He knows that many had no idea what to expect from his talk.
They believe it, that the sexual education is to teach about how to have sex. And they are going to maybe to show some people in some very exciting positions. You know, because this is the ignorance. For that reason, they are very afraid.
Que levanten la mano, por favor,
Indeed, when Dr. Molina asks if anyone had received sex education themselves, only a few hands go up. Paula Pinto has two children. She says when her elder child was growing up, she didn't know how to speak to him about sex.
Because we didn't receive quality sex education, we can't communicate with our children. And when we try, it's difficult because it is shameful to talk about this.
Dr. Molina says the stigma is rooted in Chile's identity.
Because we are very traditionalist, very classic, very conservative. They don't accept sexual education.
Dr. Molina's sex education curriculum is being put online so that schools nationwide can start using it. With figures showing 71,000 people living with HIV, Dr. Alejandro Afani, Chile's leading expert, says it's a step in the right direction. He fears there may be many undiagnosed cases because young people don't know how to get tested.
It is so important to increase access to HIV testing, especially with young people who don't normally go to the doctors. So we need to bring the tests to them at the clubs, the bars, the universities, and make getting tested a routine.
At the University of Chile, I met Matias Marin. Last year, at the age of 23, he took a free HIV test offered by the university. The result was a bombshell.
I thought I was going to die. I collapsed emotionally. I felt so bad. I knew nothing about the virus.
Matias had never had any sex education, but once he learned HIV was treatable with free medication, he started to be more positive and set up a student group to support others living with HIV.
I wanted to create a community, a safe space for people with HIV, because in Chile, this doesn't exist. People hide it and pretend they don't have it.
Although Matias feels comfortable on campus, at home it's different. It took him a year to tell his father of his diagnosis. His mother still doesn't know. Because of the stigma around HIV, he treads carefully.
That report by Paige Sutherland in Chile. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
For teenagers like me, it's hard to imagine a world where the tech we take for granted didn't exist.
We didn't have email back then. You know, everything was mail, or we didn't have internet.
So in our new podcast, Worldwise Web, 12 of us from around the world will be spending time with the people who invented it.
We believed someday everybody would have a cell phone.
Finding out how they came up with their ideas.
I'm always saying yes to the weirdest of things just so I can find all those crazy things in life that are really fun.
And asking for advice.
You got to figure out what drives you. What makes you really happy? Do that.
That's Worldwise Web from the BBC World Service.
You have conducted probably one of the greatest interviews I've ever had.
To hear more about it, search for Worldwise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, okay, we are in a new world.
And look out for the first episode on the 10th of January.
Okay, bye, thank you very much.
Now back to this podcast, and Austria's foreign ministry says it's been targeted by a serious cyber attack, which experts warn could last several days. Our Vienna correspondent Bethany Bell reports.
The Austrian Foreign Ministry has not released technical details about the attack or speculated about who may have done it. But it said that due to the severity and nature of the incident, it couldn't rule out the possibility that a foreign country may have been involved. A task force is investigating the assault, which could take several days. The Foreign Ministry statement said that despite intensive security measures, there was never 100% protection against cyber attacks. It noted that other European countries had been the targets of similar incidents in the past. The German government's IT network experienced a serious cyber attack in 2018. There were suspicions that a Russian group called Fancy Bear was involved. The group was also blamed for a similar attack on the German parliament in 2015.
Bethany Bell in Austria. Sweden is one of the world's most tech-savvy nations, with more billion-dollar valued startups relative to its population than anywhere else in Europe. This small country relies on foreign talent to plug vacancies. But hundreds of skilled workers from outside the EU have been deported over the past few years. Recently, one of them became the first to try to sue the Swedish state for loss of earnings. So what's going on? Maddie Savage reports from Stockholm.
climbing shoes.
Anil Barger is packing to head home to Australia. He's a business developer who's being deported due to mistakes made by two startups he used to work for, including failing to advertise a position on the state's public job site and paying him via a satellite company.
This situation has been, it's been tough, but there are a lot of people who are in tougher situations than me, who have families here, who don't have an easy or nice country to go back to, who embed themselves even more in the country, which makes it tougher to go through situations like this.
Sweden has a shortage of graduates in IT, engineering and programming. Yet over the past 4 years, hundreds of skilled foreigners like Anil have had their visa extensions denied. It's all down to legislation designed to protect employees from being exploited. Professionals on good salaries share the same rules as low-qualified workers.
Hi. Welcome to Centrum för Rättvisa.
Thank you, tack.
My name is Alexandra Lloyd and I'm a lawyer at the Center for Justice. The Swedish Migration Agency has been very black and white in their interpretation of the law and has said that all mistakes, they will lead to deportation of the individual. Maybe they have missed an insurance or they have taken out too much holiday or too little holiday. So it's really minor mistakes.
The rejection rate is falling thanks to a ruling by the Migration Court of Appeal, which asked the agency to make an overall assessment of each case. And there's been a change in the law which allows employers to correct mistakes in retrospect.
Hey.
Hey, San.
Hey. Yeah.
Ali Amoumi is an engineer from Iran who was told to leave his job in central Sweden in 2018 after it emerged that an energy company he'd worked for a few years previously had made an error over his health insurance. He was allowed back a year later, and he's just become the first deported worker to try and sue the state for loss of earnings.
Deportation gives me the feeling that I'm a criminal, while I know I'm not. And I think, or I hope, this lawsuit will push the decision makers to make a better legislation in which the international talent can stay in Sweden as long as they contribute. Ultimately, it will be a better Sweden for all.
The Swedish government announced it is planning a new talent visa starting in 2021, but few concrete details have been revealed, and the country's migration minister declined to be interviewed by the BBC. Meanwhile, the Swedish Migration Agency says it's got to stick to current regulations. Here's its spokesperson, Per Ek.
If you want to stay in a country and you're not allowed to stay in a country, then it's a very difficult situation. My message to everyone that are trying to seek a work permit in Sweden is make sure you meet the criteria beforehand. The rules are designed to protect the workers.
Back at his apartment, Anil says the quality of life he's got in Sweden means he'll try and return on a new visa.
It's a very cool place to live, to work. The culture is great. The tech scene is fantastic.
What do you think the stakes are if people continue to be deported based on small errors?
Yeah, well, then everything's going to go where to, like, the tech scene in Berlin, the tech scene in London. It's not going to grow as much as Sweden wants to.
It's a view shared by the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce, which recently warned that the city needs skilled foreign talent more than the other way around. Sweden may have a solid history of tech and innovation, but in an increasingly global world, its future looks more fragile.
That report from Maddie Savage in Sweden, and now to Las Vegas.
Are you ready to glimpse tomorrow? To see a future where innovation becomes reality? Are you CES ready?
Yeah, the world's biggest annual technology fair, the Consumer Electronics Show, opens this week in Las Vegas. The BBC's Zoe Kleinman is there, and James Kumarasamy asked her about getting a passenger's eye view of some of the driverless Russian technology.
I have, that's right. I've only been in Las Vegas for a few hours. It's lunchtime here in the on this side of the US. And this morning I had a drive in a driverless car that's been made by Yandex, which is a Russian tech giant, not dissimilar to Google, really. Started out as a kind of search engine and now has many fingers in many pies. What was interesting about this driverless car, and it was was a first for me, actually, was that there was nobody at all in the driver's seat. So we were driving along and the driver's seat was empty, but being totally controlled by computer. We were out on public roads in the middle of Las Vegas in the daytime with nobody in charge of the car. In many countries and sort of really up to now, you know, they've insisted, many authorities insist that there is somebody at the wheel just in case. There was somebody next to it with a big red button that was quite reassuring that apparently would have stopped the car, but it wasn't needed. It was an absolutely perfectly smooth ride once you got over the weirdness, I suppose, of sitting in the back seat and just looking straight out into the windscreen.
And I understand that during the conference itself, during the fair, there'll be other sort of self-frying implements in the kitchen, for example, unveiled.
Yeah, the amazing thing about CES is that thousands of people flock here from all over the world to show off their new inventions. And a lot of those are gadgets and they sort of fall into various themes. There's a big interest at the moment on the smart home. You know, we're sort of seeing the beginning of it now. But really, the tech firms want you to invest very heavily in things that are going to make your life easier for you, whether that's, as you said, a frying pan that weighs your ingredients for you and make sure that you are getting the right percentage of things that you need for your recipes. And there's also a shower head that's connected to a smart speaker. Not sure whether you'd want to be chatting away to somebody like Alexa while you're taking a shower, but there, you know, you can sort of see how I suppose you could be commanding your home to do stuff at the same time as you're getting yourself ready.
I suppose you can. And there's a bit of political controversy this year as well, isn't there?
Yeah, one of the keynote speakers has massively divided opinion, and that speaker is Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter. She's coming in on Tuesday to give a talk about the future of work. And it's caused controversy because a lot of people are saying, you know, there aren't enough women represented as it is in the tech sector. And there are arguably many more women with more experience in this particular field than Ivanka Trump. However, the person who organizes CES, Gary Shapiro, has defended her appearance and pointed out, you know, that she is a co-chair of the American Workforce Policy Advisory Board. She's also a co-chair of the National Council for the American Worker. So in terms of talking about the future of work, it's not a completely random thing that she would be coming here to do this. But of course, you know, this is Las Vegas. There is a bit of showbiz here, and there's no doubt that this has been deliberately chosen to get people talking.
We didn't say, Alexa, please tell us what's going on at the technology fair. We said, Zoe, please tell us, and you did. Zoe Kleinman, thanks very much indeed.
Yeah, Zoe Kleinman was in Las Vegas. Georges Deboeuf, the French winemaker who turned Beaujolais Nouveau into a global phenomenon, has died at the age of 86. He was best known for his energetic promotion of the red wine, with couriers racing to deliver the first bottles annually after their release. Catherine de Costa has been looking back at the life of the man who became the toast of wine drinkers.
Because this very new wine is so highly thought of, and because today is the first day that the French government allows it to be sold, cases and cases of it have been rushed across from France in a fierce competition to be first to get the wine to the drinker.
The Beaujolais run made news headlines with teams competing to be the first to deliver a case of Beaujolais Nouveau from Paris to London. By the 1980s, Georges Deboeuf's enthusiastic promotion of the wine had made it an annual event known across the world as Beaujolais Nouveau Day. Many went to great lengths. One year even saw a Harrier jet used to secure victory. Bars, restaurants and off-licences held tastings, sometimes lasting all day, as events spread around the UK, including the golf club at Sunbury.
They sat down to a boozy breakfast of sausage, bacon, egg and Beaujolais.
After a peak in the late 80s, British sales declined as tastes changed and competition from New World wines increased. In 2006, the Pope of Beaujolais, as Georges Deboeuf had become known, was found guilty of defrauding drinkers by mixing low-grade wine with fine vintages. He pleaded innocence, pointing out that none of the wine had gone on sale. Despite the conviction, by the time he passed the company to his son in 2018, it was selling more than 30 million bottles a year in 120 countries.
Catherine DaCosta. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.
If you're paying attention to the headlines, you've heard about ransomware, a computer virus that locks your files until you pay a ransom. But did you know that more and more businesses are under attack? The key to stopping ransomware is protecting yourself before you're attacked. With Carbonite, if your business becomes infected, you can recover clean files from their super secure servers. Best of all, you don't have to remember to upload files. Carbonite does it automatically. Try it free at carbonite.com/podcasts and receive 2 free months if you buy.